that was the decision was made literally an hour before I walked across the street to make the announcement.
Governor Walker reflects on what's next now that he isn't seeking re-election. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how will a new governor affect the existing climate task force?
How are you going to implement them? What is the next step for that? And again, we certainly hope that that continues, but we have to wait and see.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Trust Fund Land Office annual fall sale is in full swing across Alaska. Revenue generated by the Trust Land Office helps fund local programs for local people. View parcels and learn more at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Governor Bill Walker says he hasn't made plans to actively campaign for Mark Begich, who Walker endorsed to succeed him. Walker also says he's going to take some time off after he finishes his term on December 1st. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman spoke with Walker about last week and what's to come for the man who is still, for now, the country's only independent governor.
Even though Governor Walker endorsed Democrat Mark Begich over Republican Mike Dunleavy and Libertarian Billy Toyin, he hasn't planned to campaign.
I haven't. At this point, we just gotten through the announcement, and I really haven't. That wasn't part of any discussion or understanding.
The latest polling figures back that up. An Alaska Survey Research poll says having Walker actively campaign for Begich wouldn't help the Democrat. In any event, Walker says last week was challenging on a personal level. That includes the decision to end his campaign.
Sometimes you find out who you are in your darkest hours, and that was a dark hour. That was a decision was made literally an hour before I walked across the street to make the announcement. The final decision was made then, and it really was without any thought about, you know, what's Bill Walker going to do after this. That's inconsequential in comparison to what is Alaska going to look like over the next 4 years.
Neither Walker nor former Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott have provided much information about what Mallott said that caused him to resign on October 16th. Walker says he won't say more without permission from the woman who was the recipient of what Walker has described as inappropriate remarks from Mallott.
Not without her blessing, but I can say this. I'm not aware of any other instance. All the allegations of that are being sort of made up by some that are more than happy to make things up are all inaccurate and wrong. It was a one-time situation I'm aware of. It was very recent. It was an adult. And once we learned of it, it was resolved within, I think, about 16 hours.
Walker says his administration has been transparent. Not everyone agrees. Tuckerman Babcock is the Alaska Republican Party chairman.
I'm appalled that Lieutenant Governor of the state of Alaska resigns from office and abandons a campaign 3 weeks before an election. And the only information that's shared with the public is that he said something inappropriate to someone.
Republicans have also questioned how Walker will spend his remaining campaign funds. Walker says he'll largely use the money to pay outstanding campaign-related bills. He estimates the campaign spent 90% of what it raised.
You don't want to end up on election day with a bunch of money in the bank, so there won't be a big sum of money at the end, I'm sure.
Walker's name will remain on the ballot because he ended his campaign after the deadline to withdraw. But he doesn't expect many Alaskans to vote for him.
Well, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think we've done a good job of getting the word out. We didn't just do a press release on a Friday and call it good. You know, we were very open and public about what we've done and why we did it. So I think people understand that.
Walker may be wrong about that. The Alaska Survey Research poll found 5% of voters say they'll vote for him even after being informed that he ended his campaign and endorsed Begich. Walker says he hasn't focused on what comes next for him.
I need to cut some lumber, make some sawdust, and you know, go through sort of that process. For me, that's therapeutic for me to actually, you know, build things, and I'd love to build another cabin, and, you know, just kind of get out, you know, away from all the phones and the pressures that go with this position, and give some thought. And I will always do something that's going to be helpful to Alaska.
Walker says his administration will continue to work on major projects like the gas pipeline for the 5 weeks it has remaining. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
In the last week, both Republican gubernatorial candidate Mike Dunleavy and Democrat Mark Begich have received new endorsements. In a tweet, President Donald Trump threw his support behind Dunleavy, stating the Republican candidate is, quote, for energy and jobs, is tough on crime, loves our vets and our great Second Amendment. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay announced Tuesday its endorsement of Begich and two other candidates on the Democratic ticket heading into the midterms. U.S. congressional candidate Elise Galvin and House District 37 incumbent Bryce Edgman. Galvin is an independent. Edgman is a Democrat. UTBB Executive Director Alana Hurley said in a statement that each of the candidates on the so-called salmon slate have, quote, demonstrated records and policies supporting protections for our salmon and traditional way of life, end quote. The organization also applauded their opposition to the proposed Pebble Mine. UTBB's endorsement comes 2 weeks before the midterm elections. None of those Democrats' opponents, Republican Representative Don Young, District 37 candidate William Weatherby, and Mike Dunleavy, nor Mike Dunleavy, responded to a request for comment in time for this story. On Saturday, the Chilista Regional Native Corporation switched their endorsement to Dunleavy after Walker dropped out of the race. Chilista also endorsed Young. Both candidates oppose ballot measure 1. Begich supports the measure and also received an endorsement from noted alternative rock band Portugal the Man. In a tweet, the members of the band, which has roots in Wasilla, stated that they rarely endorse political candidates, but they bucked that rule this week due to Begich's, quote, long history of working to protect Alaska's wild salmon fisheries in Bristol Bay. And a quick note, both Begich and Dunleavy will be featured tonight at 7 p.m. statewide on Debate for the State, which will be simulcast on public radio stations across Alaska, as well as on television stations KAKM, KTUU in Anchorage, KYUK in Bethel, KUAC in Fairbanks, and KTOO in 360 North in Juneau. And the election is Tuesday, November 6th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska has 5 volcanoes that are categorized as a very high threat.
If you have volcanoes that tend to erupt explosively, make lahars or mud flows, other hazardous volcanic phenomena.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The South Central Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations, non-rural determinations, and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 29th and 30th starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Cordova Center in Cordova. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
When a new Alaska governor takes office in December, they'll be faced with some choices. Which priorities from the previous administration should they continue to develop, and which ones should they scrap? In September, a team appointed by Governor Bill Walker released a comprehensive plan to address climate change, but the work is far from over. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more on a historic policy in limbo.
Lately, Kristen Leiter-Reese has had her nose in a book about how huge catastrophes and natural disasters can affect cultural change. Reese is an anthropology major at the University of Alaska Southeast, and today she's leading a group discussion on Alaska's climate change action plan.
I'm going to kind of explain how I guess climate change has affected me as an individual, and then we're going to go around the room. And if
as a giant bowl of Halloween candy gets passed around, the conversation shifts between anxieties over the future to questions about whether the action plan is enough to initiate change. The plan is basically a big menu of options, including target reduction goals, establishing a bank for energy efficiency projects, and considering a stay carbon tax. Reese admires some of the ideas in the document, but still.
It is a paper report, and I feel like when you focus so much of an effort into one place, it makes it easy to just set that basket of eggs on a shelf somewhere and just not acknowledge it again, especially when you have something going on like elections, for example, last week.
Last week, Governor Walker announced he would be suspending his re-election campaign. Reese already had this discussion in the works as part of her senior project. She says the announcement changed the mood a bit, now that the policy Walker endorsed seems even more up in the air. So the question is, will the two frontrunners in the governor's race keep this team intact to work on climate change issues in the state? Here's Democrat hopeful Mark Begich.
Yes, but I also want to underline that I don't want them just to meet to meet. I want to meet to get things done.
Begich says that means identifying solutions that Alaskans can implement now. He points to things like improving energy efficiency in state and municipal buildings and incentivizing the private sector to invest in those projects. And I want to be clear. So what you're talking about is addressing this at a local level. But when it comes to passing some type of legislation to reduce emissions, is that something that you would support?
I would be interested in that, sure. But I would want to be realistic. You know, the legislature to do something, you know, while we're waiting, we'll see some more villages disappear into the water. And I'd rather get busy while we're trying to do things like that that help deal with the emissions issue and not sit around and wait for things to happen.
Begich says he wouldn't support a state carbon tax, something that was even a sticking point for Governor Walker. Republican Mike Dunleavy has also stated he's not a fan of taxes. Still, Dunleavy's remarks about prioritizing the climate action team were different from his opponents. Dunleavy's staffers said he couldn't squeeze in the time to talk about this. But in an earlier interview, he had this to say.
I think we have a lot of issues that, in my opinion, quite frankly and bluntly, are more important than the climate task force. And I'll be focusing on these immediate issues for Alaska instead of focusing on the issues in Bennett's task force.
Keep in mind, this isn't the first time an Alaska governor has assembled a team to address climate change, and priorities shifted after a change of power. Luke Hopkins knows all about it. He served on Governor Sarah Palin's work group in 2007 and recently spent months helping create the plan for the Walker administration.
Yes, it very much could sit on the shelf.
Hopkins has been here before. In 2014, after Sean Parnell was elected governor, Hopkins jokes that report sat high up on a shelf. That is, until this year, when some of those same ideas were incorporated into this more formalized policy. Hopkins says now the real work to address climate change can start. But it's hard to know what that might look like under new leadership.
All of that has to be refined. How are you going to do some of these statements? How are you going to implement them? What is the next step for that? And again, we certainly hope that that continues, but we have to wait and see.
Currently, Hopkins says there are no climate action leadership meetings planned, but the team is appointed for the next 2 years. He expects a meeting could occur sometime shortly after the governor's race. And Hopkins hopes it's not another shelving of ideas, another send-off. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The U.S. Geological Survey published its first volcano threat assessment in 2005. It was a look at every volcano in the United States and a ranking based on the hazards they pose. This week, the USGS released its first update to the threat assessment. It has five Alaska volcanoes in the very high threat category, more than any other state. But Michelle Coombs, scientist in charge at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, says the level of threat depends on the type of volcano and factors like proximity to people or flight paths, as well as the level of volcanic activity.
Different volcanoes have different characters, or you could even say personalities. There are broad categories of volcanoes, though. The ones in Hawaii are hotspot volcanoes. They're caused by a mantle plume that brings up really very hot, runny magma to the Earth's surface that tends to make long-traveled lava flows. In Alaska, our volcanoes are caused by subduction of one of the Earth's plate under another plate, and that tends to produce magmas that are wet and sticky and erupt with, erupt very explosively. So produce many more ash clouds than what we see, say, at Kilauea or other Hawaiian volcanoes. So Redoubt is one that, it erupts pretty often historically, and it poses hazards to local populations, primarily from both airborne ash clouds that can interact with aircraft or from ash fall.
Looking at the list of volcanoes that are included here, it kind of looks like one of those BuzzFeed lists. It's like the top 18 volcanoes that could get you. So the top, very high threat level volcanoes are 1 through 18. What are the factors that lead to a volcano being included in one group as opposed to another? And why is it like 18 here and then 19 through 57 is the next group? Why is that?
So I mentioned there were 24 different kind of components to the threat number. If you have volcanoes that tend to erupt explosively, make lahars or mud flows, other hazardous volcanic phenomena, those are going to get you higher scores in the hazard side of things. And then if those volcanoes tend to be near local populations, like Rainier is a great example. It's got, you know, several hundred thousand people downstream of it that could be affected by mud flows. So that gets you a high exposure ranking. Kilauea volcano in Hawaii is the top of the very high threat category. That's because it has people living on it. In Alaska, we don't have a lot of volcanoes like that. Most of our communities are away from volcanoes. Another hazard that plays into the ranking is aviation hazard. And that's one that in Alaska is a huge concern for us. We have people flying over our volcanoes every day. And as most of the listeners know, volcanic ash and aircraft don't mix very well.
This report includes a piece about a kind of a new volcano that's been included and then a couple others that were sort of demoted from the list. Yeah. And I wonder if you could tell me about that. It made me feel a little bit like Pluto when it got demoted from planet status.
Yeah. Well, the main players, so the very high threat volcanoes, those have stayed the same. We have five very high threat volcanoes in our state. Three are in the Cook Inlet and two are down Akutan and Makushin, down by Dutch Harbor and Akutan. So those haven't changed, and the vast majority of the high-threat ones didn't change either. Partly that's because they're more active, more reported activity, and we already knew about them, and they're better studied and better monitored. It's the ones on the lower half of the list where there was some shuffling. Part of that is just we live in a big state. We have a ton of volcanoes. Many of them we know very little about. And so the initial report in 2005, some of the information we had to put into those metrics was pretty sparse and not very well documented. And so in the interim, better information came out in some cases. And so I think we had six drop off the list altogether. And that's because it was determined that they have not been active in the last 12,000 years ago, a period of time geologists call the Holocene or post-glacial time. And that's kind of our cutoff to be on the list. And so six of them got off the list. Then the final one I'll mention is Four-Peaked Volcano, which is down south of Augustine and Lower Cook Inlet. And in 2006, out of the blue, that had an explosive eruption, just kind of a one-off, what we call a phreatic blast. And that caught our attention. We didn't think that volcano was historically active or even potentially active, but that put it on the radar, so to speak.
Do you have a favorite volcano? Like, do you like the ones that are explosive and active and on the watch list, or are you more like into the slow roll, beautiful looking volcanoes?
Well, I'm a geologist, so I have a few favorite volcanoes. I've spent a lot of time working on Augustine volcano and some of the ones in the Aleutians. Readout, I really like Readout. But I would say the other ones that are fascinating, and part of the reason why I love living and working in Alaska, is because there are these places we know almost nothing about. And so to go out to the Western Aleutians and go to an island where maybe one or no other geologist has ever been, and just sort of explore and be the first person to study and figure out what's going on out there, that's really fascinating as well. So I kind of like some of the obscure, mysterious ones.
Michelle, thanks for coming in and talking. I really appreciate it.
Sure. It's been a lot of fun.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. It's the time of year for people on Medicare to consider changes to their current Medicare prescription drug coverage. Plan designs can change and new plans may be available, so it's important for you to do an annual review of your plan. Open enrollment for Medicare Part D has started and will last until December the 7th. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and this station.
The Interior Gas Utility Board has a preliminary gas supply agreement with Siemens Corporation. The Memorandum of Understanding approved at an IGU meeting Tuesday does not bind either party, but directs them to work together to move liquefied natural gas from South Central to Interior Alaska. As KUAC's Robin reports, it's a big step toward a binding gas delivery contract between the international giant and the borough-owned utility.
Siemens Corporation, a subsidiary of Siemens AG headquartered in Germany, hopes to tap gas on 3,000 acres of Kennicott New Village Corporation land in South Central Alaska. The liquefied gas would then be brought to Fairbanks and North Pole on the Alaska Railroad. Eventually, IGU will request a binding contract for liquefied natural gas supply from Siemens if their price is right. But Kelly Laurel, Director of Energy and Infrastructure for Siemens Government Technologies, says Siemens can't calculate a price until certain pieces are in place.
A liquefaction service agreement and an agreeable plan to Titan One.
The Titan One plan was not at all part of the original proposal. Borough taxpayers, through IGU, acquired the Titan One gas plant near Point McKenzie as part of the purchase of Pentex and Fairbanks Natural Gas. The MOU has targeted December 31st for those two big pieces, which has board member Gary Wilkin doubtful.
What has changed that has made us suddenly believe that we can have this done in what amounts to 6 weeks?
A clause in the agreement says IGU cannot look for another gas supplier while the agreement's in effect. That exclusivity has board member Jack Wilbur concerned about meeting the public's interest.
What happens if somebody else comes to us months from now? When we're trying to make a final investment decision on Plan A, somebody else comes to us with their proposal.
Wilkin and Wilbur both voted against the Memorandum of Understanding, but it passed the board 4-2. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The worst maritime disaster in Alaska waters reached its conclusion 100 years ago today. There were over 350 people who died when the steamship Princess Sophia went down. Even though it happened near Juneau, it was not a uniquely Alaska tragedy. KTOO's Matt Miller has more in part two of the story that originally aired in 2002.
Darkness, blinding snow, and strong winds likely disoriented the crew of the steamship Princess Sophia as it left Skagway and headed down Lynn Canal. Hours later, the 245-foot ship ran aground on Vanderbilt Reef, north of Juneau. It remained sitting on the reef for a day and a half as over 340 people waited for rescue. But a passing storm intensified, and Vancouver author Ian McDonald says the 2,300-ton ship was simply pushed right off its perch on the reef.
And they said part of the reef was gleaming like a silver dollar, where when she spun around, the grating of the plates on the rock just gouged the surface, and they could see the mark where she'd spun around. Just the fury of the storm finally took its toll.
Bodies and wrecked lifeboats floated down Lynn Canal for weeks afterwards. Despite the cold water, almost all the victims showed signs of death by suffocation. They were covered in oil. Most of the Princess Sophia's crew lived in Vancouver in Victoria. The White Pass and Yukon Railway Company had over 85 riverboat crew members, captains, and their family members on the Princess Sophia. Juneau's customs collector was on board, and so was as much as 10% of Dawson City's population. Captain Leonard Locke continues to be blamed as almost solely responsible for the disaster. Was the ship traveling too fast down Lynn Canal in a blinding snowstorm? Probably. Should Captain Locke have ordered the evacuation of the ship immediately after the grounding, when the first rescue boats arrived? Perhaps. But historian Ken Coates says it's wrong to assume that Captain Locke should have taken the passengers off. They were still relatively safe and comfortable.
The ship seemed to be firmly in place. The passengers themselves were not panicking. The ship's captain was not panicking. They said, "We're stuck here. It doesn't look like there's anything that can move us. We're going to wait till the wind goes down." So, you can imagine under other circumstances, if they were grounded and were tipping over, or grounded and thought they were about to slip off the reef or whatever, they'd react very differently.
A Canadian inquiry later exonerated Captain Locke and Canadian Pacific Railway Company. Despite the enormous loss of life, the Princess Sophia tragedy is largely missing from the collective memories of northern residents. Back in 1918, the Spanish influenza was sweeping across the continent, infecting hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. and Canada, and claiming as many as 35 million people around the world. Another 10 million were killed in the Great War that was finally ending.
In general terms, there was so much happening, plus the end of this long war, that the Sophia, while in itself was very dramatic, was kind of lost in the shuffle of much bigger historical events.
It was Armistice Day. Residents celebrated. They had no desire to mourn more deaths. Historian Ken Coates also notes the victims of the sinking were from all over Alaska and Western Canada, which was much more integrated and interconnected, but many of the victims were buried elsewhere, not in the communities they originally lived. Freeze-up in the Yukon either delayed or prevented the return of bodies to northern communities like Dawson City.
Those regions were so transient that people came and left so quickly that 20 years later, there were very few non-Aboriginal people in the Yukon or even in the interior of Alaska who actually had been affected by the story. They'd left. The teachers had left. The ministers had left. The government officials were no longer there. And it's hard to keep a story alive when you have the people are on the move.
Today at Vanderbilt Reef, the small inadequate buoy has been replaced by a tall concrete and steel tower with a light, warning away cruise ships, state ferries, and fishing boats. Occasionally, a boat will still head straight for the reef, but now it's with caution and purpose.
Hey folks, if you'd wait just a moment before you put the flowers in the water, I'll maneuver the vessel so we're right over the wreck.
The ocean current carries out a trail of bright, colorful flowers that stand out against the monochrome gray of the ocean and low clouds. The flowers are a modest and temporary offering. There are no gravestones, no memorials erected here, nothing to remind passersby of those who died and those who remain buried here after the most tragic voyage in Alaska waters. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AKA Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchman in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins and Matt Miller in Juneau, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Robin in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Well, did you know that Alaska's individual market health insurance premiums are going down again for 2019? If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. You may also call 1-844-PLANS-AK for local help. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.